tune out of the anti-white system
and tune into the pro-white system on RadioAryan.com.
Hi guys, welcome back. This is the International Jew. This is going to be the fourth part. We're on page 34 of 496. Quite a ways yet to go. We've only come this far in three segments. And like I said at the beginning, if you stick with it, I promise eventually I will get to the end and you will have all of The International Jew by Henry Ford. We're going to start with the next section, which is The Jewish Question Breaks Into the Magazines. At the top of the page, they have an excerpt from the Seventh Protocol, the Protocols of Zion, and it says the following. We must force the Gentile governments to adopt measures which will promote our broadly conceived plan already approaching its triumphal goal by bringing to bear the pressure of stimulated public opinion, which has in reality been organized by us with the help of the so-called great power, quote-unquote, of the press. With few exceptions, not worth considering, it has already fallen into our hands. So, even at the time of the protocols, which is just a tad bit earlier historically than the production of these articles in 1920, I believe the protocols hit in the very early 1900s, like 1903, 1904, when the Russian translations made their way into English out of the Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland, where they actually had the meeting where the notes were recorded. So here we go, The Jewish Question Breaks Into the Magazines. Once upon a time, an American faculty member of an American university went to Russia on business. He was expert in a very important department of applied science and a keen observer. He entered Russia with the average American's feelings about the treatment which the government of that people accorded the Jew. He lived there 3 years, came home for a year, and went back again for a similar period. And upon his second return to America, he thought it was time to give the American public accurate information about the Jewish question in Russia. He prepared a most careful article and sent it to the editor of a magazine of the first class in the eastern United States. The editor sent for him, spent most of 2 days with him, and was deeply impressed with all that he learned. But he said he could not print the article. The same interest and examination occurred with several other magazine editors of the first rank. It was not because the professor could not write. These editors gladly bought anything he would write on other subjects, but it was impossible for him to get this article on the Jews accepted or printed in New York. The Jewish question, however, has at last broken into a New York magazine. Rather, it is a fragment of a shell hurled from the Jewish camp at the Jewish question to demolish, if possible, the question and thus make good the assertion that there is no such thing. Incidentally, it is the only kind of article on the Jewish question that the big magazines, whose mazes of financial controllers make most interesting rummaging, would care to print. Yet, the general public may learn much about the question, even from the type of article whose purpose is to prove that the question doesn't exist. Mr. William Hard, in the Metropolitan for June, has done as well as could be expected, considering the use he was supposed to make of such material as he had at hand. And doubtless, the telegraph and letter brigades, which keep watch over all printed references to the Jews, have duly congratulated the good editors of the Metropolitan for their assistance in soothing the public to further sleep. It is to be hoped, for the sake of the question, that Mr. Hard's efforts will have a wide reading, for there is very much to be learned from it, much more than it was anybody's intention should be learned from it. It may be learned, first, that the Jewish question exists. Mr. Hard says it is discussed in the drawing rooms of London and Paris. Whether the mention of drawing rooms was a writer's device to intimate that the matter was unimportant and frivolous, or merely represented the extent of Mr. Hard's contact with the question, is not clear. He adds, however, that a document relating to the question has, quote, traveled a good bit in certain official circles in Washington, unquote. He also mentions a cable dispatch to the New York World concerning the same question, which that paper published. His article was probably published too early to note the review which the London Times made of the first document referred to. But he has told the reader who is looking for the objective facts in the article that there is a Jewish question, and that it does not exist among the riffraff either, but principally in those circles where the evidence of Jewish power and control is most abundant. Moreover, the question is being discussed. That is the Jewish question. Mr. Hard tells us that much. If he does not go further and tell us that it is being discussed with great seriousness in high places and among men of national and international importance, it is probably because one of two things. Either he does not know, or he does not consider it consonant with the purpose of the article to tell. However, Mr. Hard has already made it clear that there is a Jewish question, that it is being discussed, that it is being discussed by people who are best situated to observe the matter they are talking about. The reading of Mr. Hard's article makes it clear also that the question always comes to the fore on the note of conspiracy. Of course, Mr. Hard says he does not believe in conspiracies which involve a large number of people, and it is with the utmost ease that his avowal of unbelief is accepted, for there is nothing more ridiculous to the Gentile mind than a mass conspiracy, because there is nothing more impossible to the Gentile himself. Mr. Hard, we take it, is of non-Jewish extraction, and he knows how impossible it would be to band Gentiles together in any considerable number for any length of time, in even the noblest conspiracy. Gentiles are not built for it. Well, that's absolutely true. You can't wrangle goys to get together and band together for their own interest. It's impossible. We've been trying to do it for years. It won't happen. Continuing on. Their conspiracy, whatever it might be, would fall like a rope of sand. Gentiles have not the basis either in blood or in interest that the Jews have to stand together. The Gentile does not naturally suspect conspiracy. He will indeed hardly bring himself to the verge of believing it without the fullest of proof. You know, that's true too. Whenever you try to talk about these facts with people, they immediately say, well, oh, that's not possible because you'd have to have 1,000 people who knew what happened. Whether you're talking about 9/11 or you're talking about the financial situation. And it's simply not the case. We have a top-down society with top-down institutions where everything is operated on a need-to-know basis. When I do my job, I don't know everything that the owner of my company knows. I only know how to make the rounds, do my little task, and take care of customers. I don't know all the inside dealings and the backroom deals that happen. And people love throwing that in your face when you talk about these things. Oh, well, that's impossible. Everyone would know about it. Well, you know, these people who go home and watch TV all day as soon as they get home from work, these people know nothing about the world. They don't study. They don't research. All they know is what's on the YouTube. So these people have problems with their own mind. They don't fully perceive reality as it exists. They have extremely cemented in their minds these mental blocks in their thinking. They have preconceived ideas of how the world is, and those preconceptions simply aren't true when you study the facts. Continuing on, it is therefore quite easy to understand Mr. Hard's difficulty with conspiracy. The point is that to write his article at all, he is forced to recognize at almost every step that whenever the Jewish question is discussed, the idea of conspiracy occupies a large part in it. As a matter of fact, it is the central idea in Mr. Hard's article, and it completely monopolizes the heading, quote-unquote, Great Jewish Conspiracy. The search for basic facts in Mr. Hard's article will disclose the additional information that there are certain documents in existence which purport to contain the details of the conspiracy, or, to drop a word that is unpleasant and maybe misleading and which has not been used in the series, the tendency of Jewish power to achieve complete control. That is about all that the reader learns from Mr. Hard about the documents, except that he describes one as strange and terrible. Here is indeed a regrettable gap in the story, for it is to discredit a certain document that Mr. Hard writes, and yet he tells us next to nothing about it. Discreditable documents usually discredit themselves, but this document is not permitted to do that. The reader of the article is left to take Mr. Hard's word for it. The serious student or critic will feel, of course, that the documents themselves would have formed a better basis for an intelligent judgment. But laying that matter aside, Mr. Hard has made public the fact that there are such documents. And then Mr. Hard does another thing, as well as he can with the materials at hand, the purpose of that article being what it was, and that is to show how little the Jews have to do with the control of affairs by showing who are the Jews that do control certain selected groups of affairs. The names are all brought forward by Mr. Hard, and he alone is responsible for them. Our purpose in referring to them being merely to show what can be learned from him. Mr. Hard leans heavily on Russian affairs. Sometimes it would almost seem as if the Jewish question were conceived as the Soviet question, which it is not, as Mr. Hard very well knows, and although the two have their plain connections, it is nothing less than well-defined propaganda to set up the Bolshevist fiction and knock it down by Jewish fact for the purpose of the latter. However, what Mr. Hard offers as fact is very instructive, quite apart from the conclusion which he draws from it. Now, take his Russian lineup first. He says that in the cabinet of Soviet Russia there is only one Jew, and he is Trotsky. There are others in the government, of course, but Mr. Hard is speaking about the cabinet now. He is not speaking about the commissars, who are the real rulers of Russia, nor about the executive troops, who are the real strength of the Trotsky-Lenin regime. No, just the cabinet he's talking about. Of course, there was only one Jew prominent in Hungary too, but he was Bela Kun. Mr. Hard does not ask us to believe, however, that it is simply because of Trotsky and Kun that all of Europe believes that Bolshevism has a strong Jewish element. Else the stupid credibility of the Gentiles would be more impossible of conception than the idea of a Jewish conspiracy is to Mr. Hard's mind. Why should it be easier to believe that Gentiles are dunces than that the Jews are clever? However, it is not too much to say that Trotsky is way up at the top, sharing the utmost summit of Bolshevism with Lenin, and Trotsky is a Jew. Nobody ever denied that, not even Mr. Brownstein himself, the latter, of course, being Trotsky's name, Brownstein. But then, Mr. Hard, says Mr. Hard, the Mensheviks are led by Jews, too. That is a fact worth putting down besides the others. Trotsky at the head of the Bolsheviks, at the head of the Mensheviks during their opposition of the Bolsheviks were Lieber, Martov, and Dan. All Jews, says Mr. Hard. There is, however, a middle party between these extremes, the cadets, which, Mr. Hard says, are or were the strongest bourgeois political party in Russia. They now have their headquarters in Paris. Their chairman is Vinaver, a Jew. There are the facts as stated by Mr. Hard. He says that Jews, whose names he gives, had the three great divisions of political opinion in Russia. And then he cries, "Look how the Jews are divided. How can there be a conspiracy among those who fight themselves?" But another, looking at the same situation, may say, "Look how the Jews control every phase of political opinion in Russia. Doesn't there seem to be some ground for the feeling that they are desirous of ruling everywhere?" The facts are there. What significance does it bring to the average mind that the three great parties of Russia are led by Jews? But that does not exhaust the information which the matter-of-fact reader may find in Hard's article. He turns to the United States and makes several interesting statements. "There is Otto Kahn," he says. Well, sometimes Otto Kahn is there, and sometimes he is in Paris on important international matters, and sometimes he's in London advocating certain alliances between British and American capital, which have to do in a large way with European political conditions. Mr. Kahn is rated as conservative, and that may mean anything. A man is conservative or not according to the angle from which he is viewed. The most conservative men in America are really the most radical. Their motives and methods go to the very roots of certain matters. They are radicals in their own field. The men who control the last Republican convention, if not the last, the most recent, are styled conservatives by those whose vision is circumscribed by certain limited economic interests, but they are the most radical of radicals. They have passed the red stage and are white with it. If it were known what is in the back of Mr. Kahn's mind, he should display a chart of what he is doing and aiming to do. The term which would then most aptly describe him might be quite different. Anyway, we have it from Mr. Hard that there is Mr. Kahn. On the other hand, says Mr. Hard, there is Rose Pastor Stokes. He adds the name of Morris Hillquit. They are, in Mr. Hard's classification, radicals. And to offset these names, he adds the names of two Gentiles, Eugene V. Debs and Bill Haywood, and intimates that they are much more powerful leaders than the first two. Students of modern influences, of which Mr. Hard has long appeared as one, do not think so. Neither Debs nor Haywood ever generated in all their lives a fraction of the intellectual power which Mrs. Stokes and Mr. Hillquit have generated. Both Debs and Haywood live by the others. To every informed person, as to Mr. Hard in this article, come the Jewish names to mind when the social tendencies of the United States are passed under reflection. This is most instructive indeed, that in naming the leaders of so-called conservatism and radicalism, Mr. Hard is driven to use Jewish names. On his showing, the reader is entitled to say that Jews lead both divisions here in the United States. But Mr. Hard is not through. The man who does more than any other man, the man who does more than any other regiment of other men to keep American labor anti-radical is a Jew, Samuel Gompers, quote-unquote. I'm sorry, that is a quote from Hard. That is a fact which the reader will place in his list. American labor is led by a Jew. Well, then, he goes on to say, the strongest anti-Gompers trade union in the country, the Amalgamated Clothing Workers, and very strong indeed and very large, is led by a Jew, Sidney Hillman, he writes. It is the Russian situation over again. Both ends of the movement which operate within the movement, are under the leadership of the Jews. This, whatever the construction put upon it, is a fact which Mr. Hard is compelled by the very nature of his task to acknowledge. And the middle movement, the liberal middle, as Mr. Hard calls it, which catches all between, produces in this article the names of Mr. Justice Brandeis, Judge Mack, and Felix Frankfurter, gentleman whose activities since Armistice Day would make a very interesting story. For good measure, Mr. Hard produces two other names, Baron Gunzburg, a Jew, who is a faithful official of the Russian embassy of Ambassador Bakhmetev, a representative of the modified old regime, while the Russian Information Bureau, whose literary output appears in many of our newspapers, is conducted by another Jew, so Mr. Hard calls him, whose name is familiar to newspaper readers, A1 Mr. A. J. Sack. It is not a complete list by any means, but it is quite impressive. It seems to reflect importance on the documents which Mr. Hard endeavors to minimize to a position of ridiculous unimportance, and it leads to the thought that perhaps the documents are scrutinized as carefully as they are because the readers of them have observed not only the facts which Mr. Hard admits, but other and more astonishing ones, and have discovered that the documents confirm and explain the observations. Other readers who have not had the privilege of learning all that the documents contain are entitled to have satisfaction given to the interest thus aroused. The documents did not create the Jewish question. If there were nothing but the documents, Mr. Hard would not have written, nor would the Metropolitan Magazine have printed the article here discussed. What Mr. Hard has done is to bring confirmation in a most unexpected place that the question exists and is pressing for discussion. Someone felt the pressure when the Great Jewish Conspiracy was ordered and written. That is the end of this particular segment, which was published on June 26, 1920. And I know, listening to this, it's kind of difficult to follow when he's talking about, I'm reading about Henry Ford and his writers writing about another guy who wrote some obscure magazine article 90 plus years ago. Almost 100 years ago, really. 97 years ago, I should say. Essentially, what happened here is Henry and his writers who wrote all these articles for him are writing about a guy, Mr. Hard, who published an article in a magazine about the Jewish question, trying to minimize the Jewish question, and he says, "This Jewish conspiracy is total nonsense. Look, the pro-labor side is led by a Jew, and he's equally combated by the capital side, who's also represented by a Jew. And what he did in attempting to talk away and downplay the Jewish question is to rather highlight how Jews control opposite sides of every movement, every discussion, every argument, every battle." And that is exactly what happens. Jews control communism, Jews control capitalism. Lenin said himself, "Do not fear the opposition, for we will infiltrate and lead it ourselves." This is what Jews do. Wherever there's a modicum of power, they will weasel their way in, grab control, grab power, and work for the best interest of their people. Now, I stopped the text when I was reading the part about trying to wrangle Gentiles together to work together as a cohesive unit, and it's like herding cats, and that's exactly true. The Jews are different because the Jews, especially nowadays, since the state of Israel and Zionism has been solidified and legitimated, the Jewish people are taught that they've been persecuted. They need to keep their guard up because the Gentiles are out to get them. And because they've been scared into that, and a lot of it is true, they have a racial consciousness. They understand that it's them versus everybody else. The Gentiles don't have that. They're totally oblivious to how the Jews rule over them and abuse them and slaughter them, etc. So, Gentiles subsequently have no racial consciousness. They don't even have a racial consciousness when it comes to Jews versus Gentiles, Jews versus Goyim. So trying to get Gentiles, trying to get white people and even blacks or Muslims to try to get together and solidify and unify their interest against Jewish power, it is impossible. You can't do it. You can't even convince people that Jews could control and wield all this power in every country. You can't even convince them of the basic facts because they see it how they would do things and how they would feel about certain things. And it's very simple. Jews are not like Goyim. They don't have the beliefs and values and mores of Goyim. They have a much more tribal mindset. They're taught from early childhood that they're Jewish, they're different, they're special, and that Jews have been persecuted and that Jews have to stick together if they are to survive. There's nothing necessarily wrong with that. I wish white people would teach their kids the same thing, because it is true, and if white people did that, white people would stick together much more often because they would look at the group's interest instead of just their individual lollygagging through life and what they would do or what they wouldn't do. If you try to judge the Jews and what they've done and what they're responsible for based off of your twisted, warped sense of morality of, oh, well, that's terrible. I would never do that. I would never lead a Bolshevik revolution and slaughter all the Russian people. Well, that's very good. That's you. We're talking about the Jews here. The Jews are totally different from you and have totally different aims and values and morals than you do. But Gentiles cannot wrap their minds around this. They can't get over it. They simply have garbage in their head. They have garbage as preconceived ideas and beliefs in their head, and they like to judge everyone else based off what they think the world should be or what it is, and they think nobody else outside of them can stray from that line of judgment. That's exactly where they go wrong. You know, serial killers exist. Pedophiles exist. Evil people exist. I wouldn't go out and do something evil, but then I don't sit here and say, when I hear a story about a rape or a murder or abuse, I don't sit there and say, oh, that's impossible. I would never do that. That's terrible. I understand that other people aren't like me. They don't have the same values and codes that I hold value in my life. But when it comes to Jewish power, Jewish conspiracy, so to speak, Gentiles have this roadblock in their head that they simply cannot get around. They simply can't fathom a group of people, a racial group, an ethnic group, a religious group of people working together for the interests of the greater group. They simply cannot understand that. And that's why they fail to understand that there is a Jewish question at all. Jews are very powerful. They've been taught and trained by their rabbis that they are enemy number one and that they need to work together as a group more than anything else, and that all that matters is what's good for the Jews. And thus, when you have that drilled into your head from an early age, networking, working together with your fellow co-ethnics becomes a sort of natural and accepted, and it's not so hard to wrangle together all these disparate people with disparate interests. So, all your stupid friends who can't understand the facts and don't want to understand the facts, that they're simply judging others based off what they think they would do or what they think's possible. And that's exactly why they're a wage slave ant of the Rothschild financial system and can't see the forest through the trees, can't see what's right in front of their nose. That they are a slave on the modern plantation, and they think that because they have a six-figure job, they have some professional job, they have some fancy toys that they've bought over their life, they think they're free, they think no one's controlling them, and they think that all this talk is pure nonsense. Meanwhile, the Jews have a stranglehold on all the power of the world. The Rothschilds have owned half of the world's wealth. Going back to like 1810, 1815, they had half the world's wealth. Anyways, I know this particular segment was difficult to understand as I read it, but this was a good commentary. This typifies what you get into with people when you try to talk about these facts and educate them. I've noticed that even in my own life, especially when it's family or friends, they try to tell me something and they're not the brightest people, and I'm not aware of what they're telling me, I tend to resist it. I did this when I was growing up with my parents. They tried to tell me, look, you can't do this, you got to do this, this is in your best interest. I simply didn't want to hear it. It's the same thing with these people. Friends, family, colleagues, they've been trained to be good little goyim. Any talk of race, any talk of an outside group having power and that white people are in danger, they start getting nervous. They start getting, oh gosh, we're talking about race or religion or ethnicity. Oh gosh, I'm uncomfortable. I don't want to be racist. They get all the little jitters and they resist any talk of it. And you can tell someone one thing and they won't believe it when you tell them. But if they had the proof right in front of them, coming from some third party that isn't you and how they perceive you, then they're more readily like and likely to accept that as fact. And this is, you know, the Jews have all this power. They control the TV. They control the media. They control publishing. Of course, they're not going to let anything get out that's blatantly anti-Semitic. They're simply not going to allow it. So, of course, the goyim never get any information, any hint that the Jews wield all this power because the Jews are covering their tracks. They're not stupid. So anyways, before I continue on with an hour-long editorial on this part of the International Jew, let's leave that there. We're at about a half hour here. Let me see this next section. See how long this is. And you know what? It looks like I can fit in another part here. So we'll move on to the next section. Now, this next section is Arthur Brisbane leaps to the help of Jewry. And there's an excerpt at the top of this page. It's a quote from Baron Montefiore. What are you prating about? As long as we do not have the press of the whole world in our hands, everything you may do is vain. We must control or influence the papers of the whole world in order to blind and deceive the people. Well, off the top of my head, I don't recall a Baron Montefiore, but I guess he's another tribesman, and I'll have to look into him later. So let's move on with Arthur Brisbane leaps to the help of Jewry. Once more, the current of this series on the modern Jewish question is interrupted to give notice of the appearance of the question in another quarter. The appearance this time consisting of a more than two-column Today editorial in the Hearst Papers of Sunday, June 20th, from the pen of Arthur Brisbane. It would be too much to say that Mr. Brisbane is the most influential writer in the country, but perhaps he is among the dozen most widely read. It is, therefore, a confirmation of the statement that the question is assuming importance in this country that a writer of Mr. Brisbane's prominence should even openly discuss it. That's quite telling in itself, is it not? Of course, Mr. Brisbane has not studied the question. He would probably admit in private conversation, though such an admission would hardly be in harmony with the tone of certainty he publicly adopts, that he really knows nothing about it. He knows, however, as a good newspaper man, how to handle it when the exigencies of the newspaper day throw it up to him for offhand treatment. Every editorial writer knows how to do that. There is something good in every race, or there have been some notable individuals in it, or it has played a picturesque part in history. That's enough for a very readable editorial upon any class of people who maybe happen to be represented in the community. The question, the Jewish question, whatever it may be, need not be studied at all. A certain group of people may be salved for a few paragraphs, and the job need never be tackled again. Every newspaper man knows how to do that, and that's exactly true. Whenever there's talk of any race, people always bring up the exception to the rule. Oh, well, I know so-and-so, and what you're saying can't possibly be true because I know this and this, and this person's good, right? Goyim love believing that. They love jumping on that and throwing it in your face, too. And yet, having lived in New York for a long time, having had financial dealings of a large and obligating nature with certain interests in this country, having seen no doubt more or less of the inner workings of the great trust and banking groups, and being constantly surrounded by assistants and advisors who are members of the Jewish race, Mr. Brisbane must have had his thoughts. It is, however, no part of a newspaper man's business to expose his thoughts about the racial groups of his community, any more than it is a showman's business to express his opinion of the patrons of his show. The kinds of offense a newspaper will give, and the occasions on which it will feel justified in giving it, are very limited. So, assuming that Mr. Brisbane had to write at all, it could have been told beforehand what he would write. The only wonder is that he felt he had to write. Did he really feel that the Jews are being persecuted, quote-unquote, when an attempt is made to uncover the extent and causes of their control in the United States and elsewhere? Did he feel, with good editorial shrewdness, that here was an opportunity to win the attention and regard of the most influential group in New York and the nation? Or, and this seems within the realm of possibilities, was he inclined simply to pass it over until secretarial suggestions reached him for a Sunday editorial, or until some of the bondholders made their wishes known? This is not at all to impugn Mr. Brisbane's motives, but merely to indicate on what slender strings such an editorial may depend. But what is more important, does Mr. Brisbane consider that, having disposed of the Sunday editorial, he is through with the question, or that the question itself is solved? That is the worst of daily editorializing. Having come safely and inoffensively through with one editorial, the matter is at an end as far as that particular writer is concerned. That is a usual thing, he's saying with newspaper writers here. It is to be hoped that Mr. Brisbane is not through. He ought not to leave a big question without contributing something to it, and in his Sunday editorial, he did not contribute anything. He even made mistakes which ought to be correct by further study. What about the Phoenicians, he asks. He should have looked that up, while his mind was opened receptively towards the subject, and he would not have made so miserable a blunder as to connect them so closely with the Jews. He would never find a Jew doing that. It is permissible, however, in Jewish propaganda intended for Gentile consumption. The Phoenicians themselves certainly never thought they were connected in any way with the Jews, and the Jews were equally without light on the subject. If in nothing else, they differed in their attitude towards the sea. The Phoenicians not only built boats and manned them, the Jew would rather risk his investment in a boat than himself. In everything else, the differences between the two peoples were deep and distinct. Mr. Brisbane should have turned up the Jewish encyclopedia at this point in his dictation. It is to be hoped he will resume his study, and when he has found something that is not printed in simply written, quote-unquote, Jewish books, will give the world the benefit of it. It's hardly like the question of rotundity of the earth. This question is not settled, and it will be discussed. Mr. Brisbane is in a position to pursue some investigations of his own on the subject. He has a large staff, and it is presumed that some of its members are Gentiles of unbiased minds. He has a worldwide organization. Since his own modification of speech and views, following upon his adventure in the money-making world, he has a look-in upon certain groups of men and certain tendencies of power. Why does he not take the question as a world problem and go after the facts and the solution? It is a task worthy of any newspaper organization. It will assist America to make the contribution which she must make if this question is ever to be turned from the bugbear it has been through all the centuries. All the talk on earth about, quote, loving our fellow men will not serve in lieu of an investigation, because it is asking men to love those who are rapidly and insidiously gaining the mastery of them. What's wrong with the Jew is the first question. And then, what's wrong with the Gentile to make it possible? As in the case of every Gentile writer who appears as the Jew's good-natured defender, Mr. Brisbane is compelled to state a number of facts which comprise a part of the very question whose existence is denied. Every other successful name you see in a great city is a Jewish name, says Mr. Brisbane. In his own city, the ratio is even higher than that. Jews numbering less than 1% of the Earth's population possess by conquest, enterprise, industry, and intelligence 50% of the world's commercial success, says Mr. Brisbane. Does it mean anything to Mr. Brisbane? Has he ever thought how it will all turn out? Is he willing to absolve that success, quote-unquote, from every quality which humanity has a right to challenge? Is he entirely satisfied with the way that, quote-unquote, success is used where it is supreme? Would he be willing to undertake to prove that it is due to those commendable qualities he has named and nothing less commendable? Speaking of the Jew-financed Harriman Railroad campaign, is Mr. Brisbane ready to write his endorsement upon that? Did he ever hear of Jewish money-backing railroads that were built for railroad purposes and nothing else? It would be very easy to suggest to Mr. Brisbane, as editor, a series of articles which would be most enlightening, both to himself and his readers, if he would only put unbiased men at work gathering the facts for him. One of the articles might be entitled, "The Jews at the Peace Conference." His men should be instructed to learn who were the most prominent figures at the peace conference. This is the Versailles Peace Conference, 1919 or 1920, maybe at the time of this writing, too. I'm not sure exactly how long it lasted. Who came and went most constantly and most busily? Who were given freest access to the most important persons and chambers? Which race provided the bulk of the private secretaries to the important personages there? Which race provided most of the sentinels through whom engagements had to be made with men of note? Which race went furthest in the endeavor to turn the whole proceeding into a festival rout by dances and lavish entertainment? Which civilians of prominence oftenest dined with the leading conferees in private session? Just to stop here and comment, the Versailles Peace Conference, the Versailles Peace Treaty, just littered with Jews. And not only Jews, but Jew millionaires and possibly even billionaires at that time. I mean, it reads like a who's who of who's powerful in Jewry at that time. Go in there and look it up. Benjamin Friedman, I'm sure you guys are familiar with that name and what he said in certain speeches. He was there, and he testifies to the fact that it was littered with Jews, and it was essentially Jews carving up Germany and redrawing the lines of Europe after World War I. And, of course, they just abused and put war reparations debt on Germany. There's no doubt that Jews were behind all of that. In any case, here, moving on with the text. If Mr. Brisbane, with the genius for reporting which his organization deservedly has, will turn his men loose on that assignment and then print whatever they bring him, he will have a story that will make a mark even in his remarkable career as an editor. He might even run a second story on the peace conference entitled, "Which Program Won at the Peace Conference?" He might instruct his men to inquire as to the business which brought the Jews in such quality and quantity to Paris, and how it was put through. Particularly, they should inquire whether any jot or tittle of the Jews' world program was refused or modified by the peace conference. It should be also carefully inquired whether, after getting what they went after, they did not ask for still more and get that too, even though it constituted a discrimination against the rest of the world. Boy, Henry's really laying it on him here. Mr. Brisbane would doubtless be surprised to learn that all of the programs submitted to that conference, not excepting the great program on which humanity hung so many pathetic hopes, the only program to go through was the Jews' program. And yet he could learn just that if he inquired. The question is, having obtained that information, what would Mr. Brisbane do with it? There are a number of lines of investigation Mr. Brisbane might enter, and in any one of them, his knowledge of his country and of its relation to this particular question would be greatly enlarged. Does Mr. Brisbane know who owns Alaska? He may have been under the impression, in common with the rest of us until we learned better, that it was owned by the United States. No. It is owned by the same people who are coming rapidly to own the United States. Is Mr. Brisbane, from the vantage point afforded by his position in national journalism, even dimly aware that there are elements in our industrial unrest which neither capital nor labor accurately define? Has he ever caught a glimpse of another power which is neither labor nor capital in the productive sense, whose purpose and interest it is to keep capital and labor as far apart as possible, now by provoking labor, now by provoking capital? In his study of the industrial situation and its perfectly baffling mystery, Mr. Brisbane must have caught a flash of something behind the backmost scene. It would be good journalistic enterprise to find out what it is. Has Mr. Brisbane ever printed the name of the men who control the sugar supply of the United States? Does he know them? Would he like to know them? Has he ever looked into the woolen situation in this country, from the change of ownership in cotton lands and the deliberate sabotage of cotton production by banking threats, right on through to the change in the price of cloth and clothing? And has he ever noted the names of the men found on that piece of investigation? Would he like to know how it's done and who does it? Mr. Brisbane could find all these things and give them to the public by using his efficient staff of investigators and writers on this question. Whether Mr. Brisbane would feel free to do this, he himself best knows. There may be reasons why he would not, private reasons, prudential reasons. However that may be, there are no reasons why he should not make a complete study of the question. A real study, not a superficial glance at it with an eye to its news value, and arrive at his own considered conclusion. There would be no intolerance about that. As it is now, Mr. Brisbane is not qualified to take a stand on either side of the question. He simply brushes it aside as troublesome, and as the old planters brushed aside the anti-slavery moralists. And for that reason, the recent defense of the Jew is not a defense at all. It's more like a bid for favor. Mr. Brisbane's chief aversion, apparently, is toward what he calls race prejudice and race hatred. Of course, if any man should fear that the study of an economic situation would plunge him into these serious aberrations of mind, he should be advised to avoid that line of study. There is something wrong either with the investigation or with the investigator when prejudice and hatred are the result. It is a mighty poor excuse, however, for an intelligent man to put forward either on his own behalf or on behalf of those whose minds he has had the privilege of molding over the course of years. Prejudice and hatred are the very conditions which a scientific study of the Jewish question will forestall and prevent. We prejudge what we do not know, and we hate what we don't understand. The study of the Jewish question will bring knowledge and insight, and not to the Gentile only, but also to the Jew. The Jew needs this as much, even more than the Gentile, for if the Jew can be made to see, understand, and deal with certain matters, then a large part of the Jewish question vanishes in the solution of the ideal common sense. Awakening the Gentile to the facts about the Jew is only part of the work. Awakening the Jew to the facts about the question is an indispensable part. The big initial victory to be achieved is to transform Gentiles from being mere attackers and to transform Jews from being mere defenders, both of them special pleaders for partisan views, and to turn them both into investigators. The investigation will show both Gentile and Jew at fault, and the road will then be clear for wisdom to work out a result, if there should perchance be that much wisdom left in the race. There is a serious snare in all this plea for tolerance. Tolerance is first a tolerance for the truth, of the truth. Tolerance is urged today for the sake of suppression. There can be no tolerance until there is first a full understanding of what is tolerated. Ignorance, suppression, silence, collusion, these are not tolerance. The Jew has never been really tolerated in the higher sense because he has never been understood. Mr. Brisbane does not assist the understanding of this people by reading a simply written book and flinging a few Jewish names about in a sea of type. He owes it to his own mind to get into the question whether he makes newspaper use of his discoveries or not. As to the newspaper angle, it's impossible to report the world even superficially without coming everywhere against the fact of the Jews. The press gets around that fact by referring to them as Russians, Letts, Germans, and Englishmen. This mask of names is one of the most confusing elements in the whole of the problem. Names that actually name, statements that actually define, are needed for the clarification of the world's mind. Mr. Brisbane should study this question for the light such a study would throw on other matters with which he is concerned. It would be a help to that study if, from time to time, he would publish some of his findings, because such publication would put him in touch with a phase of Judaism which mere complimentary editorials could not. No doubt Mr. Brisbane has been deluged by communications which praise him for what he has written. The real eye-opener would come if he could get several bushels of the other kind. Nothing that has ever come to him could compare with what would come to him if he should publish even one of the facts he could discover by an independent investigation. Having written about the Jews, Mr. Brisbane will probably have a readier eye henceforth for other men's pronouncements on the same subject. In his casual reading, he will find more references to the Jew than he has ever noticed before. Some of them will probably appear in isolated sentences and paragraphs of his own paper. Sooner or later, every competent investigator and every honest writer strikes a trail that leads toward Jewish power in the world. The Dearborn Independent is only doing with system and detail what other publications have done or are doing piecemeal. There is a real fear of the Jew upon the publicity sources of the United States, a fear which is felt and which ought to be analyzed. Unless it is a very great mistake, Mr. Brisbane himself has felt this fear, though it is quite possible he has not scrutinized it. It is not the fear of doing injustice to a race of people. All of us ought to have that honorable fear. It is the fear of doing anything at all with reference to them except unstintedly praising them. An independent investigation would convince Mr. Brisbane that a considerable modification of praise in favor of discriminate criticism is a course that is pressing upon American journalism. Published July 3rd, 1920. So there you go. Here is the second part of the program today, talking about this article that Mr. Brisbane wrote after the Jewish Question article from Mr. Hard appeared in the newspaper. Mr. Brisbane is doing what the alt-right recognizes today as virtue signaling. He came out, put the spotlight on himself to come to the defense of the poor, persecuted Jews who own half the world at that point, even more so today, probably. And he was doing this. I very sincerely doubt his altruistic motives that he may say he had in doing this, that he was coming to defend a persecuted race. Oh my goodness. He was doing this for his own recognition and to strike favor with the Jews. I mean, come on. Come on. How obvious does it have to be? Henry Ford rightly so called him out for it. I love the way he called him out for it. And I even love how he put in there, if Mr. Brisbane was serious, he would write an article on the Versailles Peace Conference and about how the Jews got everything they wanted out of the Versailles Peace Conference at the cost of all the other Gentiles there. That was great. I love how he called that out and called the reader's attention to look into that themselves. Again, here is why, even back then, 97 years ago, Henry Ford had to finance the Dearborn Independent, his own newspaper, to get these facts out there. Because the mainstream press was so concentrated in Jewish hands at that time, none of these articles would ever see the light of day. People fear going against the Jews because they control the purse strings. If a newspaper back then, even today, if they were to do this, back then, they would lose all their advertising. The Jews would organize and pull all the advertising dollars and put a boycott upon the newspapers that would go against the Jews publicly. Even so much as investigating Jewish power, that's too much. You notice any criticism of Israel, any criticism of Jews, any pointing out of the facts that does not reflect highly upon any member of the Jewish people is considered anti-Semitism or anti-Semitic persecution. And there's a reason they do this. They have to keep the lid on very tight, because if someone starts tugging at one thread, the whole tapestry of Jewish power will eventually be exposed in public light, and then it's not going to turn out good for the Jews once the goyim awaken to what they've done to them. Again, this reading this really hits me how brave Henry Ford really was. I mean, here he is, a man, self-made man, really, industrial magnate of the 20th century, more money, more power. He could be off golfing, vacationing, he could be off pleasing himself, spending his millions and hundreds of millions of dollars. He could be out womanizing, he could be out gambling, he could be out drinking, he could be out doing whatever. And what was he concerned with? Some of the same things that an ordinary blue-collar worker would. It's incredible that throughout history we have these renegades that stand up against Jewish power and do the right thing despite receiving nothing but persecution and hate for it. Even bringing up the topic, not even saying that the Jews are doing this, just bringing the Jewish question to the forefront of public conversation is enough to make you public enemy number one. God bless Henry Ford, and thank you to all of you listening. I hope that you find this enlightening and entertaining too, and that this stimulates a hunger in you, as I pray it does continue to do so for me, to look further into these things. I apologize for some of the choppy reading. The way they write this grammar, this composition, it is sophisticated, and it is hard to put it in the proper dialect and inflection with how they compose sentences, and the writing is sophisticated, and I'm not used to reading it like that. So I apologize for that. Until next time, guys, take care. Praise Christ. Praise Yahweh. 1488. Until next time, take care.
Tuned in to Radio